This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should be watching these movies.
But we're here to see if they're right.
Join us as we take a cinematic journey through independent and classic film.
So dim the lights.
And get ready for the show.
This is Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. Welcome to the podcast that isn't stinky until you fart. This is the Movie Dude Eric, and along with me is...
This is Kent, and, you know, I just have never kept anybody in a room before. And, like, just left them in there, and, like, okay, that's getting creepy even for me.
Yeah!
we'll just shy away from all that.
Well, this way, not much funny. Your Tinder has just decreased its value by, like, 600 points. So, you know. All right. But in this episode, we're discussing Room, starring Brie Larson, Jacob Tremblay, Joan Allen, Sean Bridgers, Tom McCamus, and William H. Macy, and directed by Lenny Abrahamson. Oh, boy. So, I have to say something here. I've been really dying to talk about this film for over a year. I mean, you remember back when this was sweeping all of the awards. I'd seen it, and I basically begged you and John Lobster to find this movie if it ever came out. And did you ever come across this before this episode?
No, I did not. I did not get a chance to watch it prior. As much as we all know, you also were devoting your eternal love to Brie Larson throughout the entire period.
Well, I still are. To be fair, I have been devoting my affection to Brie Larson for much longer than Room. I actually came across her back when she was on The United States of Terror with Toni Collette. And the first time I saw her there, I was immediately smitten, and yeah, so one of my bigger crushes is on Miss Larson, and has been for a while, and I have to admit, I'm very excited to see everything that she's coming up in. She was just in Kong Skull Island, which I thought she was great in that the movie I really enjoyed, and later on this month, we have her coming up in Free Fire, kind of almost like Reservoir Dogs-esque kind of single room kind of thriller caper kind of film, which I'm deeply interested in. It looks really funny. And we might talk about a little bit later with another episode we'll be doing this month. But
oh, yeah. We'll be discussing what she's filming now on Geek Sheet. So
yeah. So needless to say, I've been a fan of hers for quite a bit. But out of curiosity, this is a film that was based on the novel. Were you familiar with the novel prior to hearing about the film?
No, I wasn't. I didn't realize it was based on a previous thing until I saw that it was nominated. What, was it nominated for Oscar, or were they discussing Oscar nomination for it? I think it was... Mm-hmm. I can't remember. I know it was in the buzz for it.
Yeah, well, I mean the writer for the novel, the novelist Emma Donahue, was the person who adapted this into the film that it became, which we'll definitely be talking about as we get into the story itself. But yeah, this was a novel that I read after seeing the movie. And after reading the novel, I've actually come to an idea that perhaps there was a different approach to this film that I'm curious to see if you kind of have a different, if this will change your opinion of the film or not. We'll get into that.
Okay.
But before we do, though, let's go ahead and let's talk about what this film is about, which basically is about an abduction. It's about a young woman who was abducted as a teenager, I believe, 7 years?
Seven or so years where she's been in there. And yeah, five of it, she's now been a mother.
Yes.
So,
And now, when this, when the novel came out, I believe it came out in 2010, this really wasn't a thing that was very headline worthy, but I believe just after that, we had a string of abductees who had been found and rescued, and that kind of made this story a little bit more prominent, or it definitely gave it an extra life after these abductees had been found. And then, of course, we also have, I believe, one of your favorite TV shows, The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, also
I'm a season kind of falling behind.
Into the same discussion, right?
Yeah. Kind of the same thing.
Yeah, but do you find that the way that The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt and Room specifically, do you think that these are more sensationalist or perhaps diminutive of what really happened? Do you think that this is kind of at least kind of giving us a different take on something that in a more tasteful way?
Well, if you're going to compare it like that, Schmidt is a lot more about the aftermath. Mm-hmm. Of getting out. Well, most of the movie takes place in. Well, half takes place within the room, and then when you're out, you're only getting the first maybe 2 weeks after.
No. We're talking about at least, I want to say, about 2 or 3 months.
Okay.
I would say it's definitely. If we were to say that they were rescued in either December or January. The film ends rough around April.
Ooh.
Because it's starting to become spring, and it is snowing in the last shot of it, so I would say probably like late March.
It's kind of hard, because when he gets out, that is decent weather.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. They don't bring up Christmas at all. We don't see Christmas ornaments. So I'm thinking it's more January.
Or they get out in March.
Yeah, so. Or perhaps Akron, Ohio just doesn't believe in Christmas, you know, and that could just be the case, you know.
Because... Well, there are those godless people in Akron. Apologies to the people of Akron.
Yeah, we do have people Ohio that listen to us, Ken.
Oops. No, I was just mentioning Akron.
I see. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, you tell yourself that.
No, I don't know, I got the feeling it was more spring when he gets out. Not that we skipped most of winter, because mm-hmm. he'd have they would have been snow.
I know, and
if you're Ma, you're not gonna send Jack in December or January out. If you even suspect it's really cold out, you're gonna wait till. It gets a little bit warmer.
Technically, considering the dire circumstances that they're in, I think anything, with the exception of a full-blown blizzard, I think she would have taken the risk. Because, you know, let's get into this, because let's be honest here. The circumstances that they're in, it's gotten so dangerous to the point where they literally could be trapped in there forever. Without any resources whatsoever, and starve and freeze in a very painful, and painful condition. So I think that she would have taken the risk, no matter what the actual temperature was. Or I guess it could also be November, perhaps.
Could be going into the holidays. Yeah, so.
Perhaps. But then again, I think that at this particular point, it's. Really, all that matters is that it's a very cold, and on top of that, considering kind of their circumstances and the fact that I find it very interesting that the film itself does start off on Jack's birthday. It is his fifth birthday, and that this is where the story picks up, that this is where the film begins, and that we get the day in the life on this particular day. What did you think about kind of how they set up the normal day in this particular room? Did you kind of know what was going on from the beginning? Were you familiar with what this was going on, or did you come into this film completely cold?
I knew it was about a woman in a, basically woman in the pit who's had a child and she's trying to get the child out.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much what I knew, and that pretty much is the first half. So,
yeah.
I didn't expect it to be his point of view. Yeah. I thought it would be a little more hers, but that works. That really does get you an idea of what's...
Well, what's interesting is that the book itself that this film is based off of is entirely written from the from a 5-year-old's perspective, which may or may not be a bit annoying after a while, because it really does kind of it really does kind of give you this impression of what a 5-year-old thinks, and if that is the kind of thing that would normally annoy you, it really will get grating after about the first 30 or 40 pages. That said, though, one thing that I find very fascinating here is, considering the source material, I would have assumed, if I were reading this script or kind of looking at it from the novel perspective, I would have expected there to be kind of a more visionary kind of Terry Gilliam or David Fincher-esque kind of visual style to the film, where it definitely embellishes the 5-year-old aspect. I don't know. Part of me just was really surprised that this film really kind of took it as a matter of fact. While it does show things from Jack's perspective, it also kind of looks at these same things as kind of a fly on the wall as well, to the point where we're seeing kind of reality as it is and not the reality as Jack would see it in his mind. Even though he is the one who's giving us the voiceover, he is the, you know, everything that we see is what he sees. We don't see anything that he doesn't see in that sense. It never breaks away from him. So, do you think that you appreciate this more fly on the wall, or do you think there would have been a better film with a more visual flair to it, where perhaps there was a little bit more hyper-reality to it?
I'm not too much of a fan in hyper-reality when you're in kind of a depressed, way too grounded in realism movie like this. Plus, I don't know what his imagination would really form. I mean, he's seen cartoons on the TV, but I don't know if his imagination would take it to a point where he might imagine like that, or if everything is just so subdued by this kind of world he's in.
Well, I mean, like, one of the things that I find very fascinating here is that in the novel, Jack has this imaginary dog called Lucky.
Right.
And
which he mentions a dog frequently.
He does mention the dog, but in the novel, the Lucky plays a little bit of a larger part.
Okay.
And so I would have assumed that perhaps kind of like a Beautiful Mind aspect, where we see the dog, but we know that there's not an actual dog there. Or, you know, the dog kind of has some sort of or that we at least visualize the dog at some point. And we don't. The film kind of just plays it as, again, kind of a fly on the wall. We're seeing reality as it is, but we're seeing the reality, you know, as we're following Jack. Now, this definitely keeps the budget for the film at a very, you know, at a reasonable rate, because if you had to hyper visualize everything, we're looking at what, $10-20 million film at that particular point.
Well, you wouldn't have to do something like, you could do like how, spoilers for how Battlestar Galactica did the cat when the cat not being there was a thing, was like, you used a real animal.
Well, no,
and then you just only had Jack.
I'm not talking about just the dog. I'm talking about with any kind of the over visualization, with having props that were perhaps a little oversized or kind of have a wonky look to it. Considering again that one of the things about the novel is that he has names for all the items in this room. He makes friends with all of these items. Those are his friends, and so I would have assumed that there would have been some sort of visual cue to get that across. Instead, here, it's just basically implied that he has made friends with all these items, even though they don't. It's a non-reciprocal friendship that we're seeing here. Which, again, I guess you could kind of say is that while we're seeing things from Jack's perspective, we're also kind of seeing things from his mom's perspective.
Right.
Where, you know, she's kind of seeing him trying to deal with all of this stuff at five and not, and it's not really connecting with him exactly what he's doing because he really has no point of reference, so to say.
Right.
You know what I mean? But anyway, so yeah, let's go ahead and let's talk about it because the film is broken up into two acts. The first yes. act is inside the room. The second act is outside the room.
Outside the room.
And so
I kind of see kind of an intermission when he breaks out. It's not really being outside, but as soon as he's with it, there is kind of a thing there.
Well,
that I see as a
oh, but there's
but,
actually
yeah, it's basically
very
one and two.
Subtle hints as to the film kind of changing gears when we go outside the room. One thing that I find very fascinating is that the audio is kind of mono through the first act. Everything kind of sounds enclosed. There's a bit of a mute aspect to it. As soon as we get out, we start to hear the score a little bit more. Everything kind of has more of an open sound to it. The sounds, the sound mixing for this film is rather impressive. It's interesting here that recently we had a discussion of a whole different other room, and the sound mixing was also something that I found very fascinating about that film. As well for none of the reasons for this.
Yeah.
But no, the thing is, though, is that Room definitely has these kind of subtle hints as to inside the room and outside the room and that there's a change in the sound. I want to also say that the colors are a little bit more brighter or a little bit more varied, whereas inside the room it's a little bit more constricted. There's a lot more grays, I think.
It looks like a prison.
It is. Well, it definitely does. And on top of that, I think that it also does try to use that natural lighting from the skylight to kind of light everything. I know that for a fact that Lenny Abrahamson, boy, that's a name to say six times fast, but the director intentionally made sure to film inside the room as it is without any kind of breakaway walls and stuff because he wanted to keep the claustrophobic feel of his camera, and it required that he kind of move around the room and find unique places to put his camera to kind of capture everything. I think he said that it's kind of like playing Tetris. Which I can definitely
see.
Where
it is. Yeah.
And I believe that the filming of the room itself, I want to say, was about 3 or 4 weeks that they spent in that room. So
that's
you can only imagine.
Something.
Again, we're talking about one child actor, 9 years old, Jacob Tremblay.
Yeah.
Is 9 years old playing a 5-year old and in this cramped room the entire time. I can't imagine how difficult it was to keep a 9-year-old on task. But from what it sounds like, this kid is a genuine pro.
He's a pro
at
this.
I've actually seen him do some stuff since this. And on top of that, he's going to be playing a pretty significant part in a couple of upcoming films, which we'll talk about when we get to Geek Sheet. But yeah, this kid is on the same par as I think Haley Joel Osment. I think is one that was kind of brought to mind when in that kind of style of actor. But yeah, let's go ahead and let's talk about this because Jacob Tremblay and Brie Larson are our main characters. These are the two characters that we're following. And the other characters are very minor. It's really focused on these two specifically. Do you think that this works with it being about these two specifics, or do you think that it should be a little bit more open and that there should be more time spent with other characters?
The way it's presented, it works best as just those two, just as the prisoners and how they're adapting in and out. Anything else, the only way I could see to do it would be to break into whole chapters to say, a day in the life of old Nick, and then come back to them.
I don't want that.
And I don't, I don't think that would work too well. So, no. And really, he's about the only other character in the first act we'd even consider. And in the second act, it might be the drama of the grandparents, but...
No.
Well, there's drama going on there. We just don't see it. And really, we don't care because they weren't in the room.
Yeah. So... Well, but at the same time, though, did you wish that you kind of gotten to know what was happening with everything while they were in the room? Or do you kind of prefer to be that... You know, that's kind of not in the story itself. That really the story here is it's really about this mother and son.
The story is them. The story is mother and son. Is the prisoners, as I'll call them. But yeah, mother and son. It's anything else is side story that, you know, release a prequel in 5 years. I don't care, but it's not what's important to this story.
And what do you think of the performances?
Okay, this is where I upset you, but I think Jack should have been nominated over Brie. But hey.
That's okay. I know where you're
looking. Because you agree, he did do a good job.
But no, I honestly, I was really impressed by Jacob Tremblay. But at the same time, though, child actors are very difficult to gauge their performances because there's only so much that you can hold a child responsible for in their performance.
Right.
Because they don't have the same type of control, the same type of discipline that you would expect with an older actor who has been trained and has had years of hardcore.
Yeah.
Hardcore experience and training, whereas with a child actor, even the best, I would prefer to know that a child actor isn't putting in 20 hours of a day of performing, because I would be more concerned about that child not coming out of their childhood, meth and, Lindsay Lohan, let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
I prefer to think that child didn't have that kind of demand put on them over that. So, but at the same time, though, Tremblay is a performer. If he would have gotten nominated, if he would have won, that would have been a very... I would have been happy with that, although that would have meant that Matthew McConaughey wouldn't have gotten his Academy Award. And we'll eventually get to that one.
Yeah. Well.
But.
You know, would have gotten his award, and therefore World Peace would never have been achieved. No, wait.
but I absolutely love Brie Larson's performance here. I love this performance. I love how this is that there's several different layers to this performance. First, there is a child who's had her childhood taken away from her. There is the woman who's had to be strong for not just herself, but for her child. And especially when she no longer has to be strong anymore, that she finds herself constantly riddled with guilt over what she did to put herself in this position, as well as the choices that she's had to make and the sacrifices that she's had to put upon herself to get through this ordeal. And these are things that Brie Larson brings to the performance. And while we do get to know some of that stuff through what we hear, a lot of it really just comes off of how she performs and how she directs our gaze with her performance. And for me, that is something that's truly amazing. I believe it was my favorite performance of 2015 specifically, because she just gets it and she really just takes control. And, every scene that she's in, you're seeing all these different layers kind of coming out. And this isn't the first time that Brie Larson has done this. In fact, she's always been this kind of performer that really gets into her characters and really allows her characters to come out and plays these kind of complicated characters in a way that I find very both strong. She plays strong characters, but at the same time, they have a vulnerability to them that is very alluring to, just as a film goer. But I guess, but what do we think about the supporting performers? Let's start off with Old Nick specifically.
No.
What did you think of Old Nick?
Oh, what an asshole. Which means the actor did a great job, because we really look at him and go,
but do you consider him to be evil, or is he, or is there something a bit kind of pathetic about him?
I think his alignment is pathetic evil. And he's not even other real evil would look at him and go, "You're such an idiot. What the hell? You're just..." Did you even think this out? No.
Well, he's been successful at keeping her trapped for 5 years, or for seven years, true. For crying out loud. And that's with a child. So you can't say that it wasn't that he didn't plan things out. I mean, to get that particular far means that he had to have planned very well in order to keep her in there.
Well, he had to build it, for starters, without anybody really noticing. Unless it was already built, which is a side theory, but...
That wasn't exactly the Batcave, for crying out loud.
Yeah, well, it could have been some sort of above-ground bomb shelter, but that would be weird that it's that far above ground. You'd figure it would be
It looks like a shed. Looks just like kind of like a... when you look at it from the outside, it really does look kind of like a big shed. Yeah. So it doesn't... So it doesn't look out of the normal, or at least with any kind of shed that you would see here. I mean, it's only when you open it up and you see the soundproofing and the bed closet space and stuff like that. But, the outside of it is deceptive for the purposes that he has.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
But his whole spiel he gives, I've been laid off. It's like, what, we're supposed to feel sorry for you?
Well, no, we're not supposed to feel sorry for him to be laid off. I mean, he's definitely feeling pity for himself. But our concern, and this is where one of the things I think the film really does well here, is when the power goes out.
Yeah.
And they can't get out, and they're freezing, and we don't know if Nick is going to come back, because he's their way of getting food. He's their way of getting the necessities that they need. And if he just up and goes... They're stuck in that room, basically starving and freezing to death. And
I'm not sure if he cut it.
No.
It was cut by the utilities.
He wasn't paying his electric bills. I mean, that was the brilliance of how they set that up, by setting it up that he lost his job, so he's no longer having an income. And
is that what she's supposed to think, though? Or we're supposed to think, and he's really just being a dick.
No, he's not being a dick. When we looked inside his house, he doesn't have anything in there. He's been selling shit off.
Well, we finally see the inside after the cops have been through. They could have taken everything.
Well, no, they've
evidence.
They've taken things for evidence, but they would be regarding the room. He wouldn't have left anything in the house. And from the looks of it, all the stuff that he had... was gone. And I think that was intentionally setting up the fact that he literally had nothing. It wasn't that he was being a dick. He just wasn't paying the bills.
Or he sold it for the legal fees. Because he needs a good lawyer.
No, at this particular point, there was no way that he's going to come out of this with anything less than 20 years. But...
Oh, he was going to plea.
Well, yeah, there's a plea, but but you'll get a plea with a public defender. I said though, specifically though, it intentionally sets that material up so that when the power does go off, it's not him being a dick, it's him not being able to pay the bill. And it leaves you with the idea of, if he can no longer afford them, would he allow them to die?
Yeah.
And with that, and that definitely is the reason why we are willing to accept that she will go to any lengths whatsoever to get her son out of there, even to the point of him having him play dead.
Right.
You know,
which is a brilliant plan, actually.
It is, but it was also a really risky one. Because all he had to do was just open it up. That's all he had to do. And I also love the fact that the first time that she tries to get him, get her son out of there, it fails. And it fails because he's too scared of the boy saying anything. You know? And so, the way that they set up that progression to the succession, and on top of that, how the boy... he couldn't even talk to the person that he needed rescuing with, and that it was just that the fact that the guy was going to call the cops that he decided to ditch. You know, and I even those kind of small details, the fact that it's a dog that kind of helps the boy, and then we'll see another dog later on in the film.
That is just a strange situation where when he finally gets out and runs up to the first person just as instructed and it's like, oh, is she with you? No, we are not together.
But thing is that Jack has never seen another person. In fact, he really hadn't even met...
He has seen on TV that other people exist.
Yeah, so the thing is that he doesn't know exactly how to talk to them. He doesn't know exactly how to say anything. And on top of that, he is really scared. He basically, just think of it as being coming out of, your dimension to a second dimension. How would you respond to that? You know, especially if the entire world that you're now in is so completely different. And so I really appreciate those little details and the mannerisms that these characters are going through.
And that is a big dog. It's big to him. Well, definitely.
If I'm not correct, that wasn't it. I want to say it was a bulldog or Rottweiler.
I think it was a Rott.
I mean, it's an aggressive dog, but it was a kind dog. It wasn't a mean dog.
It's aggressive because its first instinct is something just ran up to my owner and smacked into my owner. What is this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but that's what any dog would do.
Yeah, that's the right dog reaction. It's like, there's a hostile here. And then one, Nick runs up, there's another hostile. Who's hostile to everyone? Screw this guy.
Yeah, and yet the Rottweiler was more interested in Nick than he was in Jack.
Yeah.
Which, again kind of sets up the idea that even the dogs know who the real bad guy is here. But
bigger target, bigger threat, and probably smells weird.
That's true.
So.
All right, so let's talk about the outside, and specifically kind of all the things that we would expect with this kind of rescue, so to say, which is there's media attention. There's obviously the concern about Jack's medical health, considering that he's been outside of the real world, basically this entire life, and he's been living
in a
very sheltered, no pun intended.
Had his shots, which is very dangerous for him being outside like that.
Yeah, well, again, he is in a hospital, so it's one of the reasons why he was staying there for as long as he was.
It's probably one of the first things they did was, as soon as they confirmed, yes, we have the mother. Okay, shots!
Yeah, but I also like the fact that they do also kind of bring out the psychological aspect, and that they do acknowledge that he is still elastic, that she got him out just in time, because any longer and he wouldn't be able to accept the outside world as well as he does. And
he
honest here, he accepts it pretty damn well.
He gets it quick, which I think a lot of that is Ma helping him out well and just raising him right while he's alone in there.
Yeah. And on top of that, the fact that he does kind of gradually open himself up to new people, specifically his grandmother. Hi, Joan Allen. Welcome back. Welcome back.
Hi, Joan. Okay.
Yes. I'll say here, I absolutely love me some Joan Allen, so I'm so glad that we get to talk about her again. And I love the fact that there's a complicated relationship between Grandma and Ma, and that Grandma and Jack have that there's this kind of building relationship that we see with that. And on top of that, that it does acknowledge that things have happened while her daughter was entrapped, her and the father gotten divorced. Welcome back, William H. Macy, for 5 seconds.
Woohoo!
Do you think we should have more William H. Macy?
He's in longer than that.
No, he's in two scenes. Two scenes.
Yeah.
And on top of that, he didn't even lose his shameless hair either.
Yeah. Like, okay. Yeah. Right off the set of Shameless, drive over, okay, do my lines. Yeah. But he killed it, what little he had, so.
I don't know, I think he overplayed it. But I think that in a way that the film required that he overplay it. Because, yeah. You know, because at the same time, considering that this is a man who lost his daughter, couldn't get his daughter back, lost his family over this.
Which I kind of suspect maybe it was falling apart before she disappeared.
No.
The new hubby is an old friend of the family.
Yeah, but at the same time,
Mom knew him beforehand. So here's, I think something happened.
Well, and this is something that happens when you lose a child. It's very, a very familiar thing for, you know, as soon as a child is either missing or is dead, blame starts to get thrown around. Why didn't you stop it? And people kind of cope with this in various ways. Some will either get, they'll distance themselves off from one another because to see the other one reminds them too much of their child. Or you know, if someone blames the other one for it, then that blame will kind of be transparent. And so that anytime that you're around them, it causes them to, you know, to kind of dredge up that blame. There's also the aspect of kind of keeping yourself busy, which I think is really the case here because it looks like William H. Macy threw himself into his work after his daughter went missing.
Yeah.
And that was the way for him to cope. And that when he wasn't there, she, you know, his wife got lonely and that it fell apart that way. I would, you know, you could either read too much into it or you can just basically put that, you know, that, God, I can't believe I forgot the guy's name.
Doug? The character?
No, Doug. It was,
Robert?
Crap. What was he? I want to say it was Leo. Leo!
Oh, Leo. Okay.
That's right. When I see Leo, for some reason I go back to my favorite mad scientist from Fringe. So, because he kind of looks like him, doesn't he? Let's be honest here, he does. But I'll say right here, Leo is the motherfucking man, right? Come on, that dude is freaking awesome. Like, anyway, you know how I felt about To Kill a Mockingbird, that character was, you know, the father that everyone wished they had. Leo's the granddad you wish you had, right?
Yeah.
The guy who knows his thing about cereal and dogs.
Yeah. Like,
just saying.
The
guy they'll take you out for ice cream basically just because, hey, it's like any time is a good time for ice cream, right? Just saying. The guy
point.
Is just...
I'll get back to you in 10 minutes. I'll go get ice cream. They closed half an hour ago. Damn it.
but at the same time, though, I think it's very interesting that it's Leo that Jack really kind of comes close to. Which is interesting because the only other male that he has had any connection with, even shortly, is Nick. And so to have Leo kind of be this grandfatherly figure, this male figure in his life, and that he warms up to him. But at the same time, though, he does kind of go back to grandma and he kind of switches off between Leo and grandma, right?
Well, it's almost a new parent syndrome. It's like, oh, these other people are kind of like parents to me, but it's Ma's Ma. So, but of course then Ma and Ma's Ma start butting heads.
Well, I think that at the same time, I think it's fascinating why and how they're butting heads. It's not that there's like old, these are old things that are being brought out. It's the fact that Brie Larson's character is so racked with guilt. And it's interesting because when she's in the room, she thinks only about getting out, that she doesn't really realize that after getting out, that she is going to have to deal with people again, and that she's going to have to face why and how she got in this situation. And she feels so guilty, and that even though her mom isn't overtly making her feel guilty, she is still
the whole, oh, I was affected too argument. It's like, really? You were affected? Were you trapped in a room?
Well, no, but
she lost a child, though.
Yeah, I mean, for all she knew, her daughter was dead. Yeah. And their lives were destroyed because of it. You know, it's one of those things that her mom is trying not to put pressure on her daughter, but at the same time, though, is that her daughter is kind of falling into this kind of pity party aspect, and she's trying to get her to cut out of it. Otherwise, she's going to dig herself into a hole that she's going to get herself out of, as we see when she does the interview. Because as soon as someone even so much as questions her choice as to getting her son out of that room, as soon as she has to really look in the mirror as to her choices, it completely destroys her to the point where she's willing to commit suicide over it, right? And that was what her mother was worried about. And we see that she had a good reason to worry about it.
Right? I mean, did she really even have another choice besides stay in there?
Well, the question was that the interviewer brought up was, why didn't you just have Nick send him away, you know, to take him to a hospital firehouse, you know?
It would be tempting, but I think in that situation, he might get caught too, and he might have refused.
Well,
it is her child.
I don't know exactly what Ohio's laws are when it comes to firehouses or,
I don't know
leaving
if they
children.
Have, yeah.
You know.
Indiana has that. I don't know if Ohio does. I think they do, but at the same time, we also don't know the exact situation of the birth. Was it during a blizzard? Don't know.
Even if it was just at the birth itself, it was at any other time.
Yeah.
But the thing was is that all it took was just one question, just questioning her once over this choice. And don't get me wrong, it was a valid question, but at the same time, all it took was just one question, and it knocked her to the point where that the guilt came straight back. You know, that this narrative that she had built for herself, that she is, you know, that she did the best she could, all it took was just one questioning of it, and it caused her to lose complete confidence in herself. And at the same time, I love the fact that the film doesn't say that what she did was right or wrong. It was a human choice that this character made, and she has to live with the consequences of that, both in the good manner and the bad. And I could see especially kind of how all of this stuff has been rushing toward, and while everyone was worried about Jack and his, you know, and making sure that he transitions, very few people were paying attention to her. And were, you don't see them rushing to get her a psychologist or to get her the help that she needs.
That is true. We never do see her. Well, do we never see her for Shrank because we're focusing on Jack?
That's probably so, but I would have assumed that, especially because they were going on the fly on the wall, that if that someone would have brought up that, you know, you need to see a therapist or
there
would
have been,
you know,
group therapy for both of them.
Oh, yes.
Some sessions where it would have been all the shrinks together with them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's standard procedure. If anybody's a psychiatrist, let me know. Yeah. But, you know, this is an unusual situation to begin with.
Yeah. But at the same time, though, I think that the decisions that she made were human decisions. And you could say that she was right for making them or she was wrong. For all we know, Nick would have just bashed the baby's brains in and buried it.
Yeah.
We don't know. But at the same time, though, these were the choices that she made. And all it took was just one question. Just the right question to send her over. And I will say that the suicide attempt was very painful for me to watch.
Yeah.
What did you think of it? The fact that it was Jack that found her.
Yeah, that's...
Mm-hmm.
I'm not... I kind of don't want to discuss it, but...
No, well,
yeah.
I...
Yeah.
But also, there's two reasons why this had to happen. First off, Ma needed to have this moment where, you know, she's at her lowest. On top of that, this is brilliant because this removes Ma from Jack. And Jack is now having to navigate the world without her. And so this is when he's really kind of connecting to his grandparents. This is when he starts to think about him being strong for his mother. This is when he decides to cut his hair, which I have to admit I love the fact that they pepper in the fact that Joan Allen is constantly going on about his hair. I love the fact that she looks at it and she could just tell that she just wants to cut it.
That's not right for a little boy. Do you think Nick would have handed bladed objects to
this had to be a choice that Jack makes.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that, you know, that this is something that the film allows to kind of breathe and allows it to come to this conclusion. I also love the fact that this is also the time that Jack finds another friend to play with, a boy his own age that he can play with.
I would have liked to have seen the first meeting there because I don't think that boy just shows up.
No, he does show up. I mean, it's like, you know, there's a kid in my neighborhood. Oh, yeah.
I get the feeling maybe they met before he came over. But now he has permission to always come over.
You would like an establishing shot. You would like to see the kid playing and then sees Jack and he comes over. I can understand that, but it's not necessary. What this is about is about Jack accepting the friend, accepting someone else in his life. Because up to this point, even with his grandmother and his grandfather, or, you know, Leo, however you want to put it.
Step-grandfather.
Yeah. Someone there.
Yeah.
But he doesn't fully accept them right off the bat. He whispers around them. He talks through his mother to them. This is the first time that he actively, that he actively engages with somebody else. And so this is the moment, and especially when Ma sees that he's playing with this boy, that we know that Jack's going to be okay. This is where we know that this is the end of this chapter of this story, right?
Right. He's adapted. He's going to be fine. Let's focus back on getting Ma back into the world.
Yeah. And that's what it is. It reestablishes the relationship between Ma and Jack. We have the montage of them doing everything, you know.
Montage.
I'll let's be honest here. This is a cute montage. This is an earned montage. You know, they've gone through hell. They've been tried and tested, and they've been strong for one another. So at this particular point, we get this moment where this reestablishes that bond between them. And it'll be a bond that'll be there for, well, probably the next 8 years until puberty hits, and then all hell will break loose. But up until
that, she's also out for the last 7 years. She doesn't know what the world is.
Oh yes,
so he's going to hand her a cell phone, and she's going to be like, "What the?"
She had television, dude. She had television. Okay.
Well, yeah, but she doesn't. There's a difference between seeing some of this stuff and actually interacting and going, "Wow, this has changed." So,
well, there were smartphones in 2008. So,
well, assuming that's the year, assuming this is all happening in the real time.
Well, even still.
I mean,
all right, so
it does a good job keeping itself out of a specific year, but except, you know, somehow the police have access to commsats immediately. Like,
I take it as modern day. I think there's enough.
Google satellites and Google Street View could do it, but
yeah. All right, so are we ready for Geek Sheet, or do you have anything else you want to bring up about the film?
Besides the fact it could have been a bomb shelter, I don't know. I did just have this whole impression until the end that it was sunken and a little more below ground.
You just wanted Kimmy Schmidt the movie. I admit it.
No, I just thought it was down a bit, and then we see the end, and it's like nobody noticed and wondered why there was a skylight on a shed that he never takes anything out of. Like, geez.
Well, he goes in there almost every day.
Yeah, but he never takes tools out.
And let's be honest here, people really don't pay attention to what people are doing in their backyards. This isn't Disturbia, dude.
Yeah. Depends on how nosy the neighbors are. We notice you've got this in your shed. Like, what? Well, I've had people go, "We've noticed you have this." Like, why? Why are you noticing this?
All right. So anything else you want to bring up before we go on to...
Let's just hit the geek sheet real quick.
All right, fine. So. All right, so where do we start? You start us off.
Brie Larson seemed to be joining the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
That's true.
In theory, might be filming right now as Captain Marvel, but we're not sure. But because the set is tight.
Mm-hmm.
The police officer who figures it out and should be a detective by now, god dang, those are the right questions to ask, was in Suicide Squad. What do you want to bring up?
All right, so I actually have a few here. Obviously, Brie Larson is going to be part of the part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. She was also in Kong. She was also in 21 Jump Street a few years back. Her, the one that I'm surprised that you didn't bring up was that she was Scott Pilgrim's ex in Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
I still haven't seen it. Sorry, world.
Tisk, tisk, tisk. That might not be an excuse for much longer. Hint, hint. All right. All right, so I mentioned with Jacob Tremblay, he's actually been in a couple of horror films prior to this, none that are very good, Before I Awake, which I really wanted to like, but it got a little weird. But he is going to be in The Predator coming out next year. Yes. We're not getting Arnold, but we are getting the boy from Room. So Sean Bridgers... he actually was in a few movies that I had seen last year as well. He was in The Magnificent Seven as one of the bad guys. He was in Midnight Special with Michael Shannon as one of the cult members. He has actually been in quite a bit of stuff. Specifically, he was one of the... he was one of the weirdos in Al Swearengen's bar in Deadwood, specifically. It's weird just seeing him like this. It's like, you know, him Well, I guess he isn't really playing a competent person in this movie either, but he's been in quite a bit of stuff. And on top of that, you know, we brought up Joan Allen, who, you know, Pamela Landy from the Bourne films, Face Off, and just all kinds of awesomeness. She was nominated for an Academy Award for The Crucible. She's done quite a few stuff here and there. And, of course, The Contender, which was another movie. At some point, we're going to have to do. I feel like we should do. And then, of course, Pleasantville, which she also played a character married to William H. Macy in that film.
Oh. Tough casting.
Yeah. And we did talk about her in The Ice Storm last year. Right. So, yeah. Somehow, I have a strange feeling that we are not done with Joan Allen yet. So, anyway, that's what I've got for the geek sheet.
Yeah.
So let's go ahead and let's call it. Kent, do you agree with the critics with Room? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe?
Ooh. Wait, let's not surprise us. Just give it a pass. The acting did deserve everything. The acolytes, as much as I think kids should have gotten more. But, nothing really fails in this movie at all. Everything hits on the right cylinders, tracks right. We may want people's backstories, but we don't need it for the story. So it all works for me. So I'm giving it a solid pass here.
All right. Well, I don't think I have to tell you that I give this a pass as well. I absolutely love this film. This will probably at some point make my top 100 list of great films of all time. Not because it's that the story is extremely powerful, but it's the performances that are just really so damn good, really well directed. The screenplay is actually pretty damn decent. I love the kind of the matter-of-factness of it. Do I think that it would have definitely been interesting if they would have gone a little bit more surreal or hyper-realistic? But I don't think that the film needs it. This is a film that works perfectly well, grounded in the reality that it has, and especially with the performances we have, especially specifically Brie Larson and Jacob Tremblay, who I think deserved everything that they got and probably then some. And I have a feeling that Room is going to be a film that is going to last the test of time. I honestly think that this is going to be a movie that is going to be remembered very strongly in the years to come. So, yeah, I think that Room definitely deserved everything it got, and it deserves more, in my opinion. So, pass, absolutely.
Okay.
So, if we're done with the sweet sentimentality of youth and bondage, let's get straight into the bondage as we talk about in our next episode a little Korean crime drama that came out a few years ago, which I have to admit I haven't seen before, but I've heard enough of interesting stuff that I'm kind of eager to get my hands on this. We're going to be talking about I Saw the Devil, starring Storm Shadow, of all people. Yeah. So, any last words before we call it a night?
It puts lotion on its skin. Oh, wait. Oops. Wrong movie about keeping people trapped. Okay.
Oh, my. All right. Well, this is the Movie Dude Eric.
This is Kent.
And Fiend.